A podcast of the cinema.
I said that with such finality.
You did. I believed it.
Linoleum knife. The end.
You're dead.
End of linoleum knife. Goodbye. Podcast is over.
Oh, we're just getting started. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duralde.
Yes.
We're film critics.
Correct.
I write for The Wrap.
I don't.
Co-host the podcast.
I mean, I used to.
Yes. You will again one day, I'm sure.
Maybe.
I co-host someday. The podcasts Who Shot You, Breakfast All Day, and A Film and a Movie. This show that you and I both do.
Yes.
As husbands that we are.
Husbands.
Is coming up on its 10th anniversary.
I didn't know that.
Which is I can't even begin to wrap my head around it.
You bring it up like every 3 days.
Well, it's...
You talk about it so much.
It's a thing.
Our actual 25th anniversary of being a couple is the day after, like, tomorrow.
Yeah.
You talk about that less frequently than the 10-year anniversary of this podcast.
Well, our relationship has less of an audience. Not by much, I grant you, but somewhat. Well, I'll tell you, here's the thing. Because we've made plans for what we're going to do for our 25th anniversary.
Yes.
I have no idea what we're going to do to celebrate 10 years of this podcast.
We're going to do a podcast.
We're going to
go,
yeah.
Woohoo!
But
set off a little, sparkly, noisy thing.
Okay, that'd be great. Because here's what I'm not going to do. I'm not going back through old episodes and compiling audio clips. Yeah.
That's a lot of things.
I don't know how to do that.
Also, there are too many.
And it's, yeah. No one's got time.
We just crossed over like the 500 episode.
We did. This is episode 502.
So like it's too unwieldy and large.
Yeah.
And maybe listen.
We'll just Chris Farley each other. Remember that time? Remember?
No, I don't remember. I don't remember a thing. The minute the microphone turns
this
off.
This is true. You don't.
People are constantly being like, oh, remember that time you said blah, blah, blah? My wife and I, we quote that to each other all the time. I'm like, that's funny. Did I say that? I don't remember
no
saying
memory.
That. What happened? Where was I? Who was it that said that?
In what context?
The, here's what I'll do. I'll bake a cake. And I'll write a thing on it. It'll say, okay, 10. Hooray.
And then we'll talk.
Not that I'm not excited. I'm very proud of what we've accomplished.
And we'll talk the whole show about how we're about to eat a cake and how exciting that
10,
is.
Yeah, we've done 10 years mm-hmm. of a podcast before the podcast wave began.
Yeah.
And when people looked at you, when you said you had a podcast and said one of two things, what's a podcast? Mm-hmm. Or a podcast, really? Like, those are the two reactions that you got in 2010
yes.
when you had a podcast. And, and now, it's the same, because a lot of people are like, I still don't know what a podcast is. And then everyone else is like, ugh, everybody and their stupid podcast. Mm. Yeah. Well, I'll have you know, 10 years of work.
Yeah, we're not like these people who were...
Work.
We're not these people who start podcasts because they're already famous and they just need another area to conquer. We weren't famous then, and we're not famous
we're
now.
We're still not famous, which is... Frankly, perfect.
Fine by us.
Perfect.
Who needs it?
I don't. Yeah. The
I wouldn't say no to rich, but famous, don't need it.
Is there someone offering us riches?
No.
Where is that?
Heavens no.
Where is someone offering us some riches?
I'm just saying.
I would like it.
The notion of rich and famous often go together.
It would be nice. You just made me blank my brain.
Oh, it's my fault?
Again? Yeah.
I think it's your brain. I think we should just pin this on your brain.
All right. Hey.
Yes?
Sufjan Stevens. I'm a casual fan. Like, when I hear him sing a song, I go, what a pretty song that is. Oh, it's Sufjan Stevens. He writes those pretty songs. I like them. They're very soft, real quiet songs. They're nice. And sometimes they're very sad, yes. Which is my favorite kind of song.
Yes.
But this dude is a pain.
You just
sent me this link.
Somebody asked, and he stopped
thinking about it all day. No, someone asked him a question, and he answered extravagantly.
Well, okay.
Ridiculously. Allow me.
Okay,
fine. Because I got to get this off my chest. Because again,
I don't know why you're so mad.
I'm mad. I'm mad. I don't know why I'm mad. I'm mad. You know why I'm mad? I'm mad at the president, and I'm mad at the United States.
Sure.
And I'm mad at banks and corporations, and I'm mad at the terrible, inept, incompetent, wicked, evil government we have right now. All of it. I'm mad about everything.
Yeah, I think the whole point of...
I'm mad about the watermelon that I ate after lunch because it wasn't that great.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was a little tiny, like softball-sized watermelon.
Hmm.
I'm like, personal watermelon.
Didn't bring
Actually, a 10-pound watermelon would be a personal watermelon for me. It's my all-time favorite food. But like... I opened it up and I cut it open and I started eating it and I was like, okay, it's the end of summer. The watermelons are starting to be bad again. Like you have to remind yourself what good watermelon tastes like. Gotcha. You eat it anyway.
Well, sure. Yeah.
Because you're like, I'm going to make my mouth have a good memory of watermelons from the past.
One last caress.
Anyway, I'm mad at that watermelon and it's in my belly. Well, but here's why I'm mad at Sufjan Stevens.
Yeah,
I'm going to read you the quote.
The whole point of Sufjan Stevens is to not inspire this level of passion in anyone.
I'm going to read you what he said.
Okay.
They interviewed him for The Guardian.
Uh-huh.
Asked him about performing at the Academy Awards.
Yes. He had a nominated song from Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah. By the way, he was nominated for an Academy Award. Did he win? I don't even know if he won.
Did he win? He did.
Okay.
Maybe if he'd won, he wouldn't have given this interview.
Nominated for Academy Award, performs his own song. He wrote a song, a couple songs.
Yeah.
For Call Me By Your Name.
Yes.
All right. Here's what he says. That night was, quote, one of the most traumatizing experiences of my entire life. Okay, first of all.
You had a great life.
You've had a great life. Secondly, here's what he keeps on. He keeps on.
Harping. Okay.
I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I didn't want to have anything to do with that world and that culture. He said, they failed in this article with the AV Club because what they should have written was, he sniffed. I don't want to be a part of any room full of adults hemming and hawing over plastic trophies.
Has he ever gone to the Grammys?
Probably. He said, the Oscars are a horrifying Scientology end-of-year prom. Everything I hate about America and popular culture. I have a solution for you, Sufjan Stevens. I have several solutions for you. Number one, march right up to Meryl Streep at the Oscars and tell her that. Tell her about how she's hemming and hawing over a plastic trophy. Do it. Do it. Get someone to videotape you doing that. Go tell her that. Go tell Meryl Streep that. And you know what she'll say? I'm sorry, who are you? You dumb little turd. Mind you, I'm saying this. I'm a fan. I like this guy. I like his songs. They're pretty and they're sad.
Yeah.
I like him.
I'm still waiting for
but
all his other...
He needs to calm down.
I'm still waiting for his other 48 albums about states.
Here's another thing he could do. Piece of advice. Maybe stop writing songs for movies. Because you know what happens when you do that?
Sometimes.
Sometimes you wind up getting nominated for an Academy Award for Best Song. But guess what? Has anything you've ever written been as good as Last Dance? No. So you got lucky, didn't you?
Well, I liked your other suggestion for...
I forgot what it was.
If it turns out you do find yourself nominated for a Best Song Oscar and you don't want to go to the Oscars to see it, you get Anne Reinking to perform it for you.
Anne Reinking or Liza Minnelli. She would love to sing your dumb song about gay, broken-hearted romance.
That's a good song.
It's a good song.
Let's not drag the song into this
interview. All right. The song is good. I like the song. Like I said, I'm a fan. I like his songs. They're pretty and they're sad. Occasionally, when I've seen him perform, I think, oh, what a little cutie. I'll just pinch his cheek.
Little
sing
Sufjan.
Sing me more sad songs, little Sufjan Stevens. But shut up about the pains of your life.
That was a little much. I can't hate somebody who's put out that many Christmas albums.
No, they're good. Yeah, those OG Christmas songs he writes, those are nice too.
They are.
That one, I like that one that Tracy Thorne covers on her Christmas record. Mm. I forget what it's called. Like Sister Winter or something like that. I think that's what it's called.
I don't remember.
Good song. It's about being depressed at Christmas time.
Yay.
There's nothing better than a good Christmas song about being sad.
Oh, well, sure. Joni Mitchell gets a nice check every
year. Oh, but guess what? Is it as good as River? No. So maybe you should go sit down.
If Elliot,
yeah, I feel good.
If Elliot
got that off my chest,
it could get through the evening with the help of Celine Dion.
Yeah, yeah. You know who else performed at the Oscars? Sufjan Stevens, Elliot Smith. Did he complain about it? No. Was he scared and nervous? Very much so. Celine Dion held his hand. Do you know why? She's an angel.
That's right.
Did she hold your hand? No, because you're a little puke.
Now you've done it.
What did I do?
Well, all the Sufjan Stevens fans are going to be very angry with us.
Let them come at me, bro. And sis. And
NB?
Anybody? Yeah, anybody.
Well, I'm glad you got that off your chest. I know it was really bothering you.
It's been on my... It's been stuck in my throat.
I know it's been one of the most traumatic experiences you've ever...
This article is one of the most traumatic experiences of my entire life. We have some films to talk about.
We do.
What are they? Ava, it sucks. Should we move on?
Man, no, we have to.
All right, tell people what it's about. Tell people all about what Ava is.
Okay, so
AVA, by the way.
AVA, yes, like Tenet, it is a palindrome. Jessica Chastain, globe-trotting international super assassin. You know, as you do, but she's the kind who likes to ask questions of her victims before she. She blows them to kingdom come.
Wants to know, what they like did in wrong. Real life, when an assassin comes up on you, got a job to do, got to clock out really by 5.
But they need to hear from you
first.
But
they need to know,
what did you do?
They're really priests, the assassins.
They
want to hear about your sins.
Rites. Yes,
they want to help you. You know,
into the next world.
They want to usher you through that door.
Yeah,
with the least amount of anxiety as possible. Since you are about to be murdered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
stylishly.
Of course. As always with the movie about, globe-trotting international assassins, it's either one last job or it's their bosses have turned on them and now the hunter has become the prey.
Right.
This is kind of both, but it's mostly hunter has become the prey.
Yeah.
And if it were going to just be that, I mean, it would be okay, but nothing special. But then it's also several other things that are okay, but they don't work well together. Mainly, it then also becomes this character study of this woman who we're supposed to believe actually exists. And it's about, her substance abuse issues and her family crises and her,
her ex.
Her ex, who's now living with her sister.
Her mom.
Her mom, who's played by Gina Davis.
This is the part that's good.
Yes.
This is the only part that is worth looking at.
I mean, A, fun that they cast Gina Davis in a movie about a globe-trotting international deadly assassin. Yeah. Because back in The Long Kiss Goodnight, Gina Davis got to be the globe-trotting international
with the best Amy Grantiest hair.
Yes.
That has ever been in cinema.
Yeah. It's like that movie starts like a Hallmark movie and then becomes, you know, a Rennie Harlan movie.
Right.
And the scenes between Chastain and Gina Davis are genuinely good.
Yeah, like, because you keep hoping that Gina Davis is going to be, guess what?
Like in my day.
In my day as an assassin.
Yes.
This is how we did things.
Yeah, you want like the little girl that she's dragging around with her throughout Long Kiss Goodnight to have grown up to have become Jessica Chastain. That we
but
don't get.
Unlike Michel Souvar in Beau Travail recreating the role he performed in Godard's Le Petit Soldat, Gina Davis is not playing the same character she played in The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Alas.
He sniffed.
So it just this feels very perfunctory, and it has that feel of. And, okay, John Malkovich plays her boss. And John Malkovich lately must have a really nice house in the south of France or something.
Sure.
Because he has taken on some movies.
I think there's the Michael Caine school of acting where, and the Gene Hackman school of acting.
Well, they're going to meet my quote? Great.
You're like, what time do I have to be there?
Yeah.
I'm being paid how much? It's a job. If I don't have a job, I go stir crazy and I'm mean to my wife. I say snappish things to her and she wants me out of the house. Off I go to a job. So then what Gene Hackman did was retire to Santa Fe, and he just rides his bike around town all the time.
And
I've seen the photos.
And he writes and novels.
Very happy.
He's writing novels too.
Michael Caine keeps working. and I don't know what films he's in, but
he's in Tenet.
He keeps on being in them. Oh, he's in Tenet?
Yes.
I haven't seen Tenet.
Well, neither have I, but
someday
you know,
I will, maybe.
But he's Christopher Nolan's, you know, lucky charm.
I see. Well, in any case, John Malkovich saw that the getting was good.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, people want me to be in movies. And you know, I get to go here, I get to go there, I get paid this, and yeah, sure, whatever, I'll beat it. Yeah, why not?
This feels like the kind of movie that, like, Millennium makes with Nicolas Cage or Bruce Willis, sometimes sometimes Robert De Niro, sometimes John Cusack.
He's another one, De Niro. De Niro will do anything.
Oh, well, yeah, totally. Well, De Niro's got, you know, we now know about his... He's only pulling in
7 mil this year, and he's got a lot of overhead.
He's got the house nut to pay, you know. So, yeah, it's one of those kind of movies.
Right.
But, like, you think Jessica Chastain is too cool for this sort of thing?
She executive produced it.
Well, she did, yes. And, and it's directed by Tate Taylor, who directed her in The Help.
Right. Because they're tight. Like,
they're chummy.
They're tight the way he's tight with, like,
Octavia
Spencer.
Yeah. So, you know, and here's the thing. You know, this is coming off of Ma and Girl on the Train.
Which are trash, both of them, but fun trash.
But fun trash, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, yes, he's the guy who made The Help and he made Get On Up, but he is not above, like, full-bore sort of genre, you know, cheap thrills.
Right.
And there are a few of them here. Like, there's a scene where...
There's some okay fighting, yeah.
There's some okay fighting. There's a scene where they're in Saudi Arabia, and she's just killed off a bunch of German military guys while wearing a, like, long red evening
blood
gown.
Blood red evening gown, yeah.
And as she leaves the embassy, she reaches into the slit of her skirt, rips out a big square of blood red fabric, and puts it on her head, and wraps it up and pretends to be, like, devout Middle Eastern lady with a headscarf.
Right, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, give me 90 minutes of
more of those kind of moves.
Yeah.
Money moves.
Yeah. Because beyond that, it's just, you know, and can we talk about...
Listen, a film can hinge on those sorts of little...
throwaways.
Gestures and looks and pleasures. Bad movies that you know are bad, but that give you a succession of little thrills.
Yeah.
Yes, you want to keep watching them. They don't bore you.
Exactly.
And therefore, bad though they may be, there are little sparks that fly. And this has like five sparks over a long running time. 90 minutes?
90 minutes, yeah.
That's too long.
But also, you could have a movie that is part, like, you know, Jessica Chastain goes to Narcotics Anonymous and tells really gut-wrenching stories about how horrible her father was.
Right.
And Jessica Chastain puts on a blood-red evening gown and lays waste to, like, half the German military.
Right. She's a tortured person.
This movie
internally tortured.
Yes. This movie does not know how to, like, stick that pivot. And so,
I was externally tortured.
Yeah, exactly. So it just kind of flops around. And can we talk about Common for a second?
Hello, my name is Common, and I have a rap about social justice that I would like you to listen
and
to.
And the environment. I don't get him as a movie actor.
Well, that's because he's not good at it.
Yeah. Like, you know, if we're going to talk about, like, rappers who act in movies.
Most of them are great.
Most of them are really entertaining.
Ludacris is so much fun to watch on screen.
Absolutely.
T.I. was the one delightful thing about that RZA movie that just came out. Yeah. What was it called?
Something City. City.
Something City. It was released 6 weeks ago. We have forgotten the name.
The one about Katrina.
Yeah.
Yeah, like those guys bring the thing that presumably
Queen Latifah.
Yeah,
I think of her now more as an actress than how she got her start. She got her start in hip hop.
Yeah,
and but Common you just like watching Queen Latifah in a movie.
And I'll tell you, Queen Latifah never seemed more vivid in a movie than in Just Right, because she was acting opposite Common, who was sucking the air out of every scene he was in.
Poor Common. Maybe he'll find his way someday.
He's a single threat. Anyway, so Ava, don't bother.
No, don't.
No.
No, do not. Go watch The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Yeah, that's...
Better yet, wait until December.
There you go.
It's
for Christmas.
Wonderful Christmas movie.
It is.
And again, that hair. That hair in The Long Kiss Goodnight. Better Amy Grant hair on her head in The Long Kiss Goodnight than on Melina Kanikaridis on the show Providence.
Wow.
And that show was on for like 4 years.
And it hinged on her hair.
And it hinged on her hair.
In the same way that Felicity did.
You listen. The Gina Davis out Amy Grant's Amy Grant.
Yeah.
In that movie with that hair. That long, naturally curly hair. I don't know if Gina Davis' hair is long and naturally curly. I guess in real life, Amy Grant has the edge, but made it look like it was long and naturally curly.
I'm now picturing Gina Davis in the polka dots on polka dots outfit from the Every Heartbeat video.
Do you want to remake the Every Heartbeat video starring Gina Davis?
Why not?
Starring Gina Davis now.
Sure. Why not?
Great.
Who cares?
Yeah.
It works.
We also watched a documentary.
A couple, actually.
Called Otto Lengi and the Cakes of Versailles.
Yes, we did.
From director Laura Gabbert.
Mm-hmm.
Who you just had a nice conversation with.
Yes, Laura Gabbert joins us on A Film and a Movie this week.
Your other podcast that you co-host with Daniel Thompson.
Yes.
From the Deck the Hallmark podcast. You guys co-host a podcast called A Film and a Movie.
Yes.
A name for a podcast that I wish I could ever remember. Every Monday morning,
it's
when you and I sit,
it's also hard to Google.
Every Monday morning, I sit down with you and we plan the week. We schedule the week. We talk about what's happening on each successive day. Mm-hmm. What's due? What's obligationed? Where do we have to go? Well, nowhere right now, mm-hmm. The virus. But like, what do we have to accomplish work-wise this week?
Who's zooming who?
For example. And then come Monday, I'm writing down, and then you have, at 12:30, you're recording, and you say, film in a movie. I go, that's right, film in a movie. The name of a podcast that you're on. the name I can never remember. Why? Because it's like a bookstore that's called
Books, Books, Books.
Just called Book. Book. Hey, come to my bookstore. It's called Book. Here's a name. Here's a book that I would like for you to read. It's called Book.
Steal this book. Anyway, well,
you guys had Laura Gabbert on the show.
Yes, it drops on Wednesday. The premise of the show is that we talk about older films that have influenced newer films. And in the early episodes, we had film critics as guests, and we will continue to do that. But right now, we're sort of in the middle of a run of having filmmakers on the show. And right. So we're having them talk about one of their movies and then an older film that influenced it. So Laura came on A Film and a Movie to talk about Otto Lengi and the Cakes of Versailles. And then what she chose for her sort of older inspirational movie was The Times of Harvey Milk.
Which is a great documentary.
It is a great documentary. Yeah. And she said it opened her eyes to the possibilities of nonfiction filmmaking.
In this nonfiction film,
yes,
the famous chef, Yotam Ottolenghi, mm-hmm. gets an email from the Met in New York, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and they say, hey, Ottolenghi, we want you to run the show on a gala that we're doing all about Versailles. We want you to get an A-team together of cake people and dessert people.
Did they say cake people, or did they just say we wanted a food element and he decided to go cakes?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm forgetting.
I forget. It's been 3 weeks since I've seen this film. So, in any case, out come the cakes and the dessert people.
Yes.
Including Dominique Ancel.
That's right.
The man who invented the cronut.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of other people that he sort of got from Instagram, yeah. who are accomplished bakers and chefs, but who are not household names,
no.
like Yotam Ottolenghi or Dominique Ancel.
Right.
And when I say household names, I mean household names in this house. If you don't cook and you don't follow
the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen scandal.
If you're not daily asking for the internet for new information about the Bon Appetit restructuring and what's happening with Sola. She has her own show now, by the way.
Relax, everybody.
Then you might not know who these people are, but they are accomplished, well-known chefs who have famous restaurants and famous outposts of their famous restaurants in various places in the world. There's a Dominique Ancel here in Los Angeles. We haven't been to it since February. So many delicious treats at Dominique Ancel.
I want to queen them all.
Anyway, Ottolenghi assembles all these folks. And as we were watching the movie, every time a new person showed up on the screen, I would add them to my Instagram feed because I want to know what they're doing. These are all really talented, really innovative people. And he assigns them all a Versailles-themed, you know, thing for them to make, and they invent their own thing.
Yeah, the idea being that Versailles was sort of the epicenter of cultural thought, yeah. and of innovation and of, you know, science and the arts and all this other stuff, you know, in pre-revolutionary
and
France.
Germinating class warfare.
That too. And that also gets addressed in this film.
Yeah.
But, you know, and Ottolenghi talks early on about how, like, you see these paintings where the food is featured, but, like, you don't get to smell it, you don't get to taste it, you don't get that idea. And so rather than sort of try to, you know, exactly recreate what kind of cake did Marie Antoinette not tell people to go eat?
Right, because she never said that. Yeah, right.
Instead, he was like, what would be today's equivalent of the next thing in desserts?
Right.
You know, if Versailles were happening right now, who would get called in to come be fabulous and do interesting stuff? And those are the people he calls in.
Yeah.
So you've got like Janice Wong, who has like restaurants all over Asia. She does mm-hmm. this really kind of geometric, fascinating stuff with pastry and with confectionery. Sam Bumpus, who's
she was new to me.
All these, except for Ancel, I didn't know any of them.
She was new to me, but now I follow her. And, I didn't realize that she, again, when I say not a household name, she's not a household name in this house.
Right.
Well, she is now.
Yeah. Sam Bumpus, who's half of Bumpus and Parr, who are like doing next level gelatin, I guess.
Yeah, like crazily in the shape of buildings.
Yeah, weirdly like architectural, just insane stuff. And then a woman named Dinara Kosko, who is...
amazing.
Yeah, a cake chef from the Ukraine who creates molds with a 3D printer.
Yeah.
So that she can then, you know, craft these just extravagant, gorgeous...
Like geometric...
Yeah.
Cakes that look like she folded them into shapes. Like, it's nuts. Now, okay, my my true calling in life is to be left alone in the kitchen. To bake things.
Yes.
Feed them to friends and have them tell me how lovely it is. It's all I really want out of life. I'm a middling film critic, but I'm, you know, pretty good in the kitchen. I've spent 20 years waiting for a film about cake. Now here is one. This is my moment. It's the kind of movie that you can just sit back and relax while you watch, because not only is it very chill, there's no, like, will they make it in time? You know, like, none
manufactured drama, yeah.
A couple of, you know, passive-aggressive chef moments tossed out where you're like, ooh, drama, you know.
But mostly the pastry chef at the Met is a bit of a...
Yeah. Maybe he was having a bad day.
Maybe he was. I would never judge someone's entire life based on 5 minutes of footage in a documentary, but it does not play well for him.
Anyway, it's very chill. And what a person like me wants from a film like this is the absence of burden. Like, I don't, like, okay. Example. Last Friday, we watched the first episode of the new season of The Great British Bake Off. Mm-hmm. In America, it's called The Great British Baking Show.
Yes.
I feel burdened often by that show because I think, oh, y'all are amateur home bakers. Lies.
Oh, are you?
You're one step below getting a job in a real place making real stuff. Like, the stuff that the folks on that show can do is light years from what I can do. I have successfully made one thing from Great British Bake Off. And it wasn't even the British one. It was the American Christmas version.
Right.
The candy cane bread.
Well, it's the only thing you've tried. It's not like you...
That's because everything else is too hard. Too dang difficult. Now, a film like this, people who are at the top of their game...
You don't have to think at all.
You don't have to even think about, like, you...
Of course you can't.
Of course, you'll never do that.
Right.
Like, it's impossible. Yeah. Like, you should have learned about making cakes when you were 6, become a pro by 17, and then spent 30 years becoming perfect.
Yes. If you weren't clutching the skirts of your grandmère, who was herself a Michelin 2-star pastry chef.
Exactly. So anyway, this film goes down very easy. It's that kind of comfort documentary that honestly I like quite a bit. And the themes of this film. Not only is it about, you know, presenting baking and dessert making as the art form that it genuinely is.
Yes.
But the gala itself, you know, you can be critical of them for a variety of reasons. But on one level, they do, you know, they do promote sort of the forward-looking achievements of artists.
Yeah.
And that is what, for all of its, you know, terribleness, Versailles did the same thing.
And this movie is very smart about kind of connecting the dots
between what
happened to Versailles and where we are now.
Right. It raises all the questions about luxury and privilege and hunger and deprivation.
And inequality of income, of wealth, and
And it's not about food necessarily as an aspirational experience. It's about food as
a universal experience.
History and art and fashion. And, you know, in the case of actual Versailles, about what led to the guillotine.
Yeah, and the movie's smart enough to understand that, yeah, you know, those blades are being sharpened as we speak.
Oh, we have another documentary that is all about the guillotine.
Oh, yes, we do. But hang on, I'm not done here. Oh,
okay.
And also, you know, and I complained last week when we were talking about The Way I See It, about the sort of wave of kind of what feel like commissioned documentaries,
yes,
where it's all about this one person and how great that one person is.
Right.
This one, at least, I think, like you said, it doesn't try to build crazy drama and stuff, and it is showing people being good at their job.
Right.
But it's not trying to sell you, like, Yotam Ottolenghi. It's not trying to sell you Dominique Ancel. Like, these people were already accomplished, and it is more about the process. You know, like, here's this thing that they had to do, here's them doing it, here's what they did.
Yeah.
And so I never got the feeling that it was sort of like, that it was, you know, like, exit through the gift shop and buy, you know, Ottolenghi's latest cookbook. Like, it doesn't have that feel.
No, not at all. Not at all. So, yeah, I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's really good.
It didn't make me want to chop off the heads of anyone in the film.
No. It did make me want to cut into a few eclairs, though.
Yeah. Push. Documentary from Swedish filmmaker Fredrik Gerten.
Yes.
Will make you want to chop off the heads of lots of people.
Oh, yes. Or at least some corporations. And they are people.
Here's what it's about. Leilani Farah, who at the time of the filmmaking was the UN Special Rapporteur, a word that I've never pronounced until now.
I like to think of Common as a rapporteur.
Stop it. you quit that right now. She was the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing.
Yes.
Now she's the director of a global housing initiative known as The Shift. Mm-hmm. The film follows her as she goes literally around the world, yeah, talking to people who are suffering at the hands of giant investment concerns that are buying up residential properties in big cities, and not even in big cities, like a lot of places. Mm-hmm. Not for people to live in, but to use as financial assets,
yeah,
that they then can buy and sell and trade and, like, many times a day, sometimes, mm-hmm, that fast, because of internet and because of trillions of dollars.
Right.
But it's not just that they're buying up property to let them be empty. They are doing that.
Yeah.
They're moving into, you know, run-down places, buying up property, kicking people out.
Yeah.
Leaving them houseless.
Yes.
With no ability to afford anything in the city they live in anymore, because this is such a plague now in the world. So now real estate is no longer about a place to live. It is a very complicated financial instrument used by people with more money than you'll ever have and less morality even than perhaps Donald Trump. And they are extracting the wealth from cities and from people and destroying the planet.
Yeah. They are removing people's ability to
live and work in the places where they have jobs.
Yeah. And, you know, and while on the one hand, it's like, you know, it's the kind of doc that makes you feel hopeless. It also sort of, you know, you see this woman in her duties figuring out a way of, like, how do we trace the money here? who's right. bankrolling these faceless corporations
right.
that are taking Blackstone. Up all this space?
Blackstone is the name of one of them.
Yeah, which if you were writing a movie and you called your nefarious corporation Blackstone, you'd get notes saying that was too on the
nose. Go to Blackstone's Twitter account and look at the way people talk to Blackstone. Yeah. It will give you hope.
Anyway.
Because they're all sharpening their knives.
But she starts figuring out, like, who's actually investing in this company and how they can be stopped from investing in this right. company and companies like it. And so you
governments are going to have to enact policy to stop this from happening.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, this is basically like the credit reverse default swap, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Except now it is, 10-story building with empty condos that just displaced several apartment buildings,
right.
and none of the people who live in those apartment buildings can afford to live in that new building or anywhere nearby.
Well, no one's offering those spaces for sale anyway.
Exactly.
They're not meant to be lived in. If you live in them, you depreciate them. And so they keep them...
You take it out of the box.
Yeah. Along the way, not only does she go around the world talking to people... She talks to experts. She talks to this one woman who's brilliant, Saskia Sassen. She's a sociology professor. Mm-hmm. And this may not sound like a film you want to watch, but it is so engaging, and it moves at such a good, energetic pace. It's not homework.
No.
And Leilani Farah is this inspiring example of what can be done when one person refuses to give up or be silent.
It will make you think about aspects of the world that you might not already be thinking about, and it will make you think about various issues in a way that you maybe haven't thought about them before.
It will make you very angry.
It will.
But it will also but the film keeps itself so based in humanity that, you know, the thesis comes through, and that thesis is we have to work together on the ground to take care of each other, because the faceless investors live on another moral planet that they think belongs only to them.
Yeah.
And so the goal of the rest of us is to demonstrate to them that it does not belong to them.
Indeed. Before we get to our other films this week, we have a sponsor.
Yes,
Our good friends at Ovid. So much stuff going on over there. It's like, you know, we've been sort of spotlighting a few individual things, but I just want to kind of run through a lot of really cool stuff they've got over there. They are the first platform to present the restored version of From the East, from the legendary Chantal Ackerman.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a documentary fan, we've just been talking about a couple of docs. They've got Nancy Cooperstein Charney's Who's Next, which is about the lives of Muslim Americans in the years since 9/11. And also Anna Moot Levin and Laura Green's The Providers. There's a whole abstract cinema section with an interview with Stan Brakhage and lots of experimental films. There is Camille Claudel, which earned Isabella Gianni an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. Just all kinds of different stuff. If you are somebody who likes the deeper cuts that we get into on this show, the smaller indie films, the foreign films, the docs, this is a great place to find it. And we're so thrilled that they are supporting the show, and they are supporting our members by making a very special offer for listeners to Linoleum Knife. You can get 50% off the first 3 months of your Ovid.tv subscription by using the promo code Linoleum. Linoleum. Linoleum gets you 50% off.
Spell it right.
Off the first 3 months of your subscription at Ovid.tv. That's O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David, .tv.
You know what they have right now?
What's that?
Two films that begin with the letter W that I want everyone to know about.
What's that?
They have the Andrea Arnold Wuthering Heights.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is the most down in the mud.
I was gonna say, the brackish Wuthering Heights.
It's the grimiest Wuthering Heights. And it's also the coldest and the wettest, and therefore it is perhaps
my favorite.
and shockingly, here's the biggest shock of the Andrea Arnold Wuthering Heights. Over the closing credits is a great song, all right?
Yeah.
By, speaking of people who write music for movies, you're going to laugh at me when I tell you who wrote this great song for Wuthering Heights.
Who, Dave?
Mumford and Sons.
Whoa. You are not usually
that's true.
Brought to hyperbole by Mumford and Sons.
No, I am not. Anyway.
It must be something
also
else.
The World of Gilbert and George drops tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Today is Tuesday the 28th. It drops tomorrow the 29th.
All right.
It is a 1981 documentary about weirdo artists Gilbert and George,
they
who
are indeed
delightful.
I do love an aggressive eccentric.
And that is what they are. That's on Ovid.
Promo code so Linoleum.
Check it.
Ovid.tv.
Yeah.
I saw Enola Holmes, and you did
I not. Did not. I don't. I don't care about any film that stars Henry Cavill if he does not have a mustache and he is not fighting people.
Well, you know, maybe in the sequel.
The least he can do is take off his shirt.
He is young Sherlock Holmes in this movie, but not as young as young Sherlock Holmes was in Young Sherlock Holmes.
Okay. Explain the movie and tell people about it, because
okay.
I didn't watch it.
This is based on, I believe, it's a series of YA novels. Enola Holmes is the younger sister of both Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes. Her older brothers have long since grown up, gone to school, left the house.
Yeah.
She is being raised in the manor by herself by their mother, who is... Enola is played by Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things.
Who I did not know was British.
Yes.
Until now.
Yes, she is.
Right.
And she finally gets to use her own voice. And her mother's played by Helena Bonham Carter, who's a lot of fun in this.
Mm.
And, you know, her mother is giving her a full education in, you know, science and hand-to-hand combat and all the kind of things you need to know when you're a Holmes. But, you know, not necessarily preparing her for marriage, which is what, you know, young ladies of the period were supposed to be doing. Anyway, one day the mother goes missing, and Mycroft and Sherlock come home. They are sort of aghast at the state of the manor house and at the state of Enola, that she's not nearly, you know, ladylike enough. They want to, at least Mycroft wants to shove her off to finishing school. But Enola runs off to try and find the mother using the many clues that the mother left behind. And she encounters a young nobleman who is himself on the run. And so suddenly she's got kind of two cases to solve. It is a lot of fun.
Is it now?
Yeah.
All right.
It is not perfect.
Okay.
For one thing, it is directed by Harry Bradbeer. You may not know that name.
I do not.
He directed all but one episode of a show that we liked very much, Fleabag.
Okay.
Guess what Enola Holmes does a lot in this movie?
She steals her stepmother's erotic art. Stepmother played by Olivia Colman.
Sadly, no.
No.
And maybe we'll get to that in the sequel, too.
I bet I know.
What is it, Dave?
Talks right up to that camera.
She talks.
Looks you right in the face. Talks to you in that camera.
Much to that camera.
Hello, I'm here in a movie. I'm talking to you.
That fourth wall is gone, baby,
okay.
Gone.
All right. I don't mind that. That doesn't bother me.
It gets old fast. For
all
me.
Right.
In this case, like I didn't mind it in Fleabag, but in this, it was like, oh, all right.
I realized that I said weeks ago that I hate that, but I've changed my mind.
Okay, good.
For now,
you're volatile.
I may hate it again someday.
you're a will-o'-the-wisp. You know, there are some really fun sequences. Millie Bobby Brown is having a great time, and she's a lot of fun to watch, and it's an interesting character. I like how much agency she has. I like how the Holmes brothers can barely keep up with her. But there's, it almost feels like, and I don't know if this is the case because I haven't read any of the books that it's based on, but this has that feel of when they do one of these YA movies and they take two separate novels and mush them together. Because just The Pursuit of the Mother or just the stuff with the young Marquis would be a movie.
Yeah.
And both of them is a lot, and they don't. It's diverting, and it's hard to kind of focus on both of them at the same time. And the movie is over 2 hours long, which it does not need to be. But
how much over 2 hours?
Like it's hang on, it's okay, 2 hours and 3 minutes. But still,
all right.
It could be trimmer.
All right.
I will say this: if they make another one, I'm on board.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
okay.
I think it's the kind of thing where, like, now that we've established everything and we've done all the architecture of world building and character building and stuff, and we could just run right into a new adventure, I'm totally on board. This one is good, and it's worth seeing. There are people online who are loving it.
Loving it.
And I'm like...
People we know?
some people we know and some people just, you know, in the ether. And I'm like, I'm glad you're enjoying this.
I just want to know, like, whose opinion? Is it someone I have to think about? Is it someone I listen to or someone I don't listen to?
I couldn't say.
Because we know a lot of people.
We know a lot of people.
But I don't respect everyone's opinion.
Anyway, so yeah, I think there's a lot to like here. It's worth checking out. And I'm totally down for the return of Enola Holmes.
Okay. Cajillionaire. All right. This is the new film from Miranda July. You love her or you hate her, Miranda July.
I've done both.
I've done one. The one that I have done is to love. I love her. I love her films. I loved The Future, and nobody loved The Future.
Ugh.
But I loved it. Actually, Richard Brody loved it. He's right.
I'm sure he did.
He's right.
I love Richard. We never agree on anything.
This stars Evan Rachel Wood, Richard Jenkins, Deborah Winger, and Gina Rodriguez. Evan Rachel Wood plays a young woman in her 20s who has been... I don't even want to use the word raised by by her parents, Deborah Winger. Yeah, in the same room with quite often.
Yes.
Her parents are willful outsiders in a way that they think is liberating, but that has in fact been completely... warping to their child. She's in her mid-20s and she does not leave home because you don't leave home.
Right.
Because there's nowhere to go because they don't have any money. They live in Los Angeles in the valley on what I think is Burbank Boulevard, frankly, on that stretch of
that scans
businesses industrial that are like auto glass and, you know, tire rims and...
Well, they're living in what is obviously an office. It still has cubicles.
Yeah, they're living in an abandoned office space that is connected to a bubble factory. And when I say bubble factory, I mean the name of the company is Bubbles, and they manufacture bubbles. And the bubbles leak through the walls into the disused office space where the three of these people live. And for a break on rent and for lenience in terms of when that rent is paid, their task is to collect the bubbles in trash cans by scooping them up off the wall as it leaks into...
Through the ceiling.
Through the ceiling into the space. These scenes of the bubbles leaking into the space and them collecting the bubbles are some of the most hypnotic imagery I have seen in a film all year long. Funny and frightening at the same time. Beautiful and heartbreaking to watch. I felt a little messed up watching this film because in many ways it is like Running on Empty, that film with Judd Hirsch and Joe Beth Williams and Young River
Phoenix. No, Christine Lottie.
Christine Lottie. And Young River Phoenix as a family on the run.
Yeah.
Now, this family is not on the run.
No.
This family is stuck.
Yeah.
But the brutal effects of its of the years on the kid in the family is kind of what the story is about, because Evan Rachel Wood's character is stunted and distrustful. She cannot be touched by anyone. She doesn't want anyone touching her.
Because her parents never have.
Her parents have never touched her, so she doesn't want anyone touching her. Her parents have never treated her like a child, even when she was one. They are cold and weird and self-obsessed.
Mm.
And the way they get by is by running scams.
Yeah.
And they're little penny ante nickel scams. And they're always on the verge of ruin because they don't think big with their scams or their little robberies or heists. And one of the reasons that they keep it small, you'll learn as you watch the film, and this is not a spoiler, their scams are done within the context of other people's families, so that they sort of invade the life of another family for a moment, for the opportunity to engage in familial settings without having to commit to it.
They're cosplaying
family. The thing that they reject, and they will say strongly, vociferously, that they hate that stuff, that it's a trap, that it's how they get you.
Yeah.
It's the thing they all really want.
Yeah.
But Evan Rachel Wood doesn't know that she wants it because she's never had it. Everything to her is alien. Then they meet Gina Rodriguez, who thinks their life is kind of amusing, and she wants to get in on a scam,
yeah.
get in on a heist, because she thinks, oh yeah, they're going to get some money. And then she realizes that they don't really ever want to get much money. They just want to get enough money to pay the rent, and then they want to go to 7-Eleven and steal some food, you know. They want to go to Target and buy things, and then someone else's credit card, and then return it for money. Like, it's never anything major. The film is being sold as a heist comedy, but no one's really doing much heisting.
Mm.
They're just grinding their gears.
And it's a comedy in the Miranda July sense of the word.
The way I like it.
Which is not to say it's not funny, but it's not like if you're being sold a heist comedy.
Right.
That might be stretching it. By the way, this is currently only in theaters, and we do not suggest that you go to theaters.
Do not go to a theater. It's going to be streaming in 2 weeks.
Yes.
On the middle of October, it begins streaming. So unless you can see it at a drive-in right now, don't go.
Just wait.
Don't go to a movie theater.
Yeah, I like this quite a bit. And it reminded me of what I like about the other Miranda July movie that I like, which is Me and You and Everyone We Know. And I even see what she's trying to do in the future, even though I don't like it and I don't think it works. But this notion where she will spin a yarn and give you these characters that on the surface appear to be like quirky or offbeat or,
right.
you know, surreal or whatever.
Whimsical is the word that she gets tagged with all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a damning word
yeah.
when people use it toward her. And I don't agree with it at all.
Like, yeah, you can accuse her of a lot of things, but like twee is about the last thing that you could.
Not at all.
It's funny, when you were talking about the whole thing with the bubble.
But she is light and delicate and feminine, and that is bad for a lot of people.
I suppose
especially
so.
Especially a lot of dudes.
Mm.
And a lot of, more tough-minded folks.
Sure.
And therefore, you know, that gets hung on her a lot. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you. Continue.
Anyway, when you were talking about the bubble thing, it's sort of, that in itself is kind of a microcosm of the whole movie, in that the sight of these bubbles leaking through the walls and them having to, like, scramble to scoop them up and throw them out.
It's always a scramble.
Yeah. On the surface is kind of funny and odd and weird, but the more you think about it and the more you realize what it represents and what it says about their lives and the decisions they've made and the kind of thing that it represents, it breaks your heart.
Yeah.
And that's what the way this movie was. It was like, it is, on the one hand, about these people who are scam artists who are very bad at being scam artists.
Right.
But at the same time, it ultimately just becomes this really sort of heartbreaking thing about this family that doesn't know how to be a family and says it doesn't want to be a family, but clearly does want to be a family. I know it's that's the kind of movie that pushes your buttons even harder than they do me. but it works. And I liked it a lot. I turned to Dave 20 minutes in. I said, who's playing the mother? And he turns to me and goes, Deborah Winger. I did not recognize her at all.
Yeah.
She and Evan Rachel Wood have this like sister wife hair, this mm-hmm. like long straight hair that goes to their knees pretty much.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's unnerving, but it's also funny, and it's ultimately very moving.
Miranda July builds these sort of holistic environments that are impervious to outside normalcy of any kind of outside normalcy that you would encounter in a real day-to-day life. This will, you know, again, put off some audiences, but her characters are just sort of manifestations of internal breaks, internal breakage, and like I said earlier, warping.
Yeah.
Her people are giving you everything that everything they are on the outside, rather than making you wait for a mid-film explanation of why they're doing what they're doing.
Did you see the short that she did a couple of years ago? I think it was out of the Venezuela. Oh,
right? Did you?
And she actually it's about an app, and she created the app. And I don't know if anybody really used it, but basically it was like if there was a text that you wanted to send to somebody, but you were awkward or embarrassed about doing it,
right.
It would send the text to somebody who was near that person, and then you would have to go walk over to them and read them read them the message. And again, on its surface, it's just ridiculous. But then it's also about how, like, because of texting and because of social media and stuff, like, so much of our face-to-face interaction is going away. And this was this idea of, like, well, what if you got somebody else to have this conversation for you on your behalf? And then at least that way, this stranger and the person you're trying to contact, they would have a face-to-face connection.
She has, I think, this immense empathy for her characters and just for people. And she allows the actors to communicate all of that inner stuff, all that frailty and all that melancholy and all that longing. And they keep saying they don't need each other, and then they really, really, really do. And she then connects her people to strange external circumstances, like I was saying earlier, that it's outside of your reality. Mm-hmm. It's the bubble factory. It's also, in this movie, it's a series of earthquakes. Like, more earthquakes than you would ever experience living in Southern California in any stretch of time.
And on top of it, the dad, and well, I guess both the parents, have this whole thing about how, like, you can't touch anything during an earthquake because everything is electrified.
It's that dogtooth thing of, my parents made up a thing, I believe it, no one ever told me otherwise because I don't have contact with any other people.
It's like,
and it's a lie.
It's like when I talk about an expression from one of my parents, and you go, is that like a thing in Spanish or something your parents said? And I'm like, how would I know?
I was raised in a little Spanish bubble in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah. I have no idea what's just their quirk and what's a, you know, a general Iberian trait, you know?
And there, you know, and in this film, again, like I said, weird circumstances. There may also be a brief trip into outer space, but we don't know. We're not sure.
Anyway, do see it.
I love it so much.
Do see this in a couple of weeks.
I do love this film.
It's showing at home.
It's her best movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Evan Rachel Wood is... And Deborah Winger, well, the whole cast.
They're all great.
The whole cast. And Gina Rodriguez gives the best, are you kidding me, faces.
Yeah.
Like, through the whole, like, she's like, oh.
I've never seen
you guys are utterly deranged, and why am I here? Maybe there will be some money. And then maybe I become connected to you as well. You know, I won't spoil anything.
I've never seen her be this good.
I've seen Gina Rodriguez in very few things, actually. Mm. She was in Annihilation.
Right.
I know she was on Jane the Virgin, but a show
that's,
I never
watched. That's true.
I never watched.
Now that you mentioned it, I haven't seen her in a ton either, so it's not fair to say.
Never seen her in much.
She's quite good in this.
Yeah. Okay, now, I saw a film that you did not see.
Yes.
We got six movies to talk about this week. I saw The Green Years. Mm-hmm. Now, The Green Years is currently playing in virtual cinemas. It's from... it is a film from 1963. It has been restored. by Pedro Costa, who is a filmmaker I really love, and whose film from earlier this year, Vitalina Varela, is one of my favorite movies of the year. He's a Portuguese filmmaker, and he has overseen I don't know if he oversaw it, but he helped get this film restored from Paulo Rocha, who was a pioneering new Portuguese cinema filmmaker of the 1960s. Basically, the Portuguese equivalent of the Nouvelle Vague.
Gotcha.
And it is the story of a young man who comes from the country to Lisbon in the early 60s as Lisbon is super modernizing. And that is communicated by these shots of these beautiful modern buildings, lots of really sort of like mid-century futuristic looking door handles onto these big tall buildings. It's not done in a comic way, but it's sort of like that Bressanian hand thing where it's like, oh look, hands on door handles. And look at that door handle. Like when he touches it, it's as though he doesn't know how to open a door because he's from, you know, a rural area. Mm-hmm. And this city is this big, alienating, gleaming, shining thing that's still trying to figure itself out. In fact, one of the people that he meets right at the beginning of the movie is an old man who helps him find directions. And the old man says, this place is paradise. And you know that's bad news. When someone tells you at the beginning of a film that you're living in paradise, you ain't living in paradise.
There's nowhere to go but down.
He gets a job working in a shoe repair shop that very much like in the film Parasite, where the family lives, it's in a basement. Mm-hmm. And the window where people bring the shoes is sort of like at knee level. So people stoop and they put the shoes through the thing. And one of the customers is a young woman, also from the country. The guy is played by Rui Gomez, and the young woman is played by Isabel Ruth, who became a well-known actress in Portugal, worked a lot with Manuel de Oliveira. And so she's the maid. She comes from the country too, but she works for a rich family. So she gets to experience some of the paradise that Lisbon could be, but not much. They start hanging out, and they slowly become couple-ish. But everything they do feels awkward. They don't fit in the city, and she's trying to, and he's not really figuring it out. Like, there's this really great scene where they're trying to dance to rock and roll because it's new in Portugal. And he's not good at it. And she's like, no, come on, come on, come on, come on. We'll do it. We'll just do it. And we'll watch the other people. And he's just sort of stumbling. So instead of falling in love, instead of Paris Belongs to Us, which is, you know, the Jacques Rivette film, mm-hmm. in which Paris belongs to young people, Lisbon does not belong to these young people. These are young people for whom Lisbon is a trap. Things take a turn for the worse.
Oh, good.
But I won't give that away. Because it's a fairly shocking turn of events, and I don't want to spoil it. What an amazing, amazing film this is from a filmmaker that I had not heard of until a few weeks ago. Didn't know how influential he was. It took, again, Pedro Costa to bring him to my attention. Mm. And now this restoration and re-release is happening. So if you've never heard of Paulo Rocha, the filmmaker, if you've never heard of The Green Years, this is a bit of film history that you can, you know, see. Mm. And see in a nice, brilliant, little crisp restoration. It's a gorgeous film. There's so much great formal visual stuff going on here where, you know, the world sort of swallows up these two young people. And the way they walk through space in this film, like having to like climb up a hill that's got no path, you know, or, you know, deal with architecture that doesn't belong to them. Everything about it is telling you the story. It's not just, you know, thing happens, thing happens, thing happens.
Right.
So great. So go to your local virtual cinema, The Green Years.
Where did you get it?
Well, Grasshopper is the distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the Grasshopper site, it gives you a list of a bunch of virtual spaces that you can see it in. And the one I chose was Acropolis, which is a local... what do we call Acropolis here in town?
It's like a floating screening series.
It's a floating screening series. Yeah, it moves from theater to theater back when we moved from theaters to theaters. And they screen, you know, the impeccably curated... selections of its operators. If you live in Los Angeles and you have seen anything that Acropolis has shown, you have seen amazing stuff. They have amazing taste, and not just like in films that make you feel good about yourself. You know, like, I feel so much smarter now that I've been here. But, like...
Quite to the contrary,
These are films that, you know... It's like watching those... It's like watching the Strobe-Huillet films. I feel like I'm learning when I watch them. You know, that's what's really... That's what Acropolis does in Los Angeles. Vital thing that used to be done by Cine Family. Now they're doing it. La Collectionneuse does it as well. So yeah, I clicked on Acropolis to give them 50% of my ticket price.
Well, all right.
$12.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have a DVD pick?
I don't. I've talked too much. I've seen too many movies. End of cinema.
You've taken in too much with too fine a filter.
That's right.
Mine is, there's a lovely Criterion Collection release of Miranda July's first film, Me and You and Everyone We Know.
Oh, well.
And it's got a new interview with her and Lena Dunham. It's got a lot of short films and...
What's Lena Dunham got to do with it?
They brought her in to interview Miranda July.
All right. Okay.
They're peers.
I guess they are, yeah.
And if you are not as... down for physical media as I am, it is also streaming on the Criterion channel. We have some letters.
Do we indeed?
Yes.
This is a letter from Lucas. Hello, Dave and Alonzo. Last episode, number 501. The Buttonfly episode.
Yes.
Dave mentioned not being sure on the terms Filipinx and Latinx. Now, I can't talk for everybody, especially Filipina people. But as a trans and non-binary Brazilian, I can say where we are in Brazil, and as far as I know, the Spanish-speaking countries of South America, Latinx is mostly outdated, or perhaps just not adopted, I'm not sure. Some cis people have just started picking it up, but usually queer groups don't use the term anymore. Okay, so outdated, yeah. Well, that was fast.
Keep up.
As far as I know, there are still ongoing discussions about gender-neutral terms, but for now, what we've been using is Latine, meaning the termination E as neutral.
Gotcha.
If E is already masculine, then we use U. So, Latine, Latina.
Well, right, but this
not
is...
ah, or...
Okay, but this is also, remember... In Brazil...
This is Portuguese.
This is Portuguese.
Okay. Well, now I'm just more confused. Anyway, I might as well say why X is no longer in use. In both Portuguese and Spanish, X doesn't really sound right at the end of a syllable like that. Well,
true.
It doesn't sound right at the end of English either.
Also true.
So, like, that's where... But that's not my problem. My problem is not being able to pronounce it properly. I'll learn to pronounce anything as long as it's not the double R, because I can't do that.
Yes.
My mouth won't make that sound. But I just want to know what folks want.
Right.
You know, if I'm talking to you, I want to know what you want me to use.
Apparently, okay, the idea of X was to degender Spanish and I guess Portuguese adjectives.
Right.
But obviously, if Spanish and Portuguese speakers don't use the X at the end of a sentence, then it's that's back to the drawing board.
Well, it sounds like it only matters what queer users of these languages say, because much like mainstream culture in any country, the mainstream is often quite anti-queer, and they don't want to listen to you when you ask them to say what you want them to say in the first place.
Yes, but I think in this case, the issue isn't about what LGBTQ people want to be called versus what non-LGBTQ people want to call them.
Right.
I think it's about some LGBTQ people coming up with a workaround, and then other ones saying, that's great, but it doesn't work in our language.
I see. Okay. Lucas continues, in both Portuguese and Spanish, X doesn't sound right at the end of a syllable.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to go against that, X started being pronounced as E. This, however, was still an issue because auto-reading programs wouldn't recognize words and then would butcher them, which became a problem for disabled people.
Oh.
So, I'm still waiting to learn more about what I'm supposed to say and to whom.
What it sounds like, and we had another letter about this as well, which I didn't throw in because they were very concurrent. The idea is to replace the X with the E, which is also gender neutral, but is makes sense pronunciation wise in Spanish.
Yes.
We will continue to investigate this. If you have thoughts, please let us know.
Whoever is the most persuasive and has
is the winner.
Is the winner. Because I want everybody to have what they need. And not just me.
I will sign on that.
Letter from Gabe.
Okay.
Been a big listener since 2011. Thanks to you guys. Been able to open my mind as a film critic. He's a film critic now.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. Because I've spoken to him many times about this.
Okay.
Then there are a few sentences about how we're the nice gay uncles, which I'm very appreciative of, but I'm always very embarrassed by praise. So I'm just going to skip the praise.
We're going to put it on the refrigerator with a magnet.
Yeah. He says, here's my list for knifing in no order.
Okay.
There will be blood.
Oh, yeah.
It says, my all-time favorite film that really made me pay attention to the details of the filmmaking process.
Hmm.
Moulin Rouge.
Okay.
Moulin Rouge is like what I was talking about earlier. Is it a good movie? I don't know.
Who can say, really? It's like putting an entire Whitman sampler in your box.
But I remember watching it for the first time at the press screening and thinking, I'm going to have a heart attack. And that was before Kylie shows up as the absinthe fairy. I got a soft spot. I got a soft spot for it to this day.
It's extravagant.
Do the right thing.
Okay.
He says, I saw this when I was 15. He goes, I saw it when I was 15 and it opened my eyes. Blade Runner.
All right.
It made sci-fi my favorite genre.
Hmm.
Mean Streets.
Okay.
He says, it was my first Scorsese film.
No.
Well, that's a good place to start.
Sure.
Yeah. The Wolf of Wall Street.
Okay.
My parents wouldn't let me see it.
Go.
So when I finally did, I just thought it was the best one ever. Let me tell you, I think that's why I love Tommy so much.
Oh.
Because I was prevented from seeing it as a child.
The taboo of it all.
Even though it was PG. Mm. It was hard PG. It was PG back before we had PG-13.
Right.
Oh, my God. Tommy should be rated R.
We just got this this like 4K box of Hitchcock movies that are coming out.
Yeah.
Psycho is rated R now.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. But anyway, when I finally did get to see Tommy, I was still pretty young, and I was like, man, this is the best. I'm an adult. Still love it now. Go to see it at the Cinematheque whenever, well, I did go see it at the Cinematheque when they would show
in
it.
In the before time.
Mm-hmm. Paddington. You guys said it best. It is the coziest.
Dang Skippy.
Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, okay.
He says, as someone with mental illness in my family and a healthy case of generalized anxiety disorder, this film spoke to me on a lot of levels.
All right.
Plus, when I had a bad panic attack during school one day, my mom surprised me and drove me to the 2-screen art house theater to see it. I had a good mom. Seven Samurai.
Okay.
I saw this recently.
Hmm.
And it has stuck with me on a level that I cannot describe. Well, here's a level. Here's the reason. It's fantastic.
Hmm.
That's why.
Yeah.
Election.
Oh, yeah.
I know several people like Tracy Flick.
We all do.
Well, yeah. Me too.
Some of us marry them.
I'm. She makes me uncomfortable.
That's I
identify with her a little too much.
That's
sometimes.
That's a 100% knife.
It's 100% knife, Gabe. You win.
Bravo.
You win the knifing.
You do.
We're done.
We're done.
It's the end of the show.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. You know, do check out my other podcasts. Yeah, like I said, Laura Gabbard is coming up on A Film and a Movie, and we have quite a few other very exciting filmmakers in the near future. So you don't want to miss that. And also check out our many, many podcasting friends on the internet. Go see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to with the critically acclaimed network. Check out The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, Secretly Timid, All Things Cozy, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Deck the Hallmark, Criterion Cast, and Fat Guys of the Movies. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It does help people find the show. You can also leave lovely, gushy feedback in all the places that you get your podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, thelounge.com, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean, you name it. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. He's at Bluetopia, at BLEUTOPIA on Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at LinoleumCast. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. And, of course, a reminder, use the promo code Linoleum to get 50% off your first 3 months of Ovid.TV. Oh, and we have a Patreon page.
Yeah.
It's swell.
Sure.
Extra content, other things. Go check it out. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good week. Take care of yourselves and each other. We'll see you next time. And until then,
eat the rich. I mean, goodbye.
That too.